This is Pamela Banos, and I'm speaking with John Austin, the Executive Director of the Museum of Funeral Customs in Springfield, Illinois. We're standing in the museum in front of two examples of Fisk metal burial cases, one of which is or appears to be black iron, shrouded around, or there's, well, you describe it for me, John.
To me, it looks like a draped figure. And some individuals have suggested that the design itself might have originally been inspired by William Cullen Bryant's poem Thanatopsis, in which he ends the poem by talking about an individual lying down upon one's couch and wrapping one's cloak around him. So I think that's kind of the inspiration, which kind of fits with the patent date for the general concept of creating the cast iron burial case as an impervious container for burial purposes.
Now, this particular model has a cover over the face, which I understood, or at least compared to the model next to it, which we'll talk about in a second, was like a portal, like a glass window over the face area. This particular one looks like it's covered.
Exactly. No, if we were to remove the octagonal panel, there would be a glass pane there so that individuals could be sealed inside the coffin or burial case, as Fisk called it. And this then would simply protect the glass covering. But for viewing purposes, the panel could be removed.
For whose viewing purposes?
The living.
So for the funeral?
Right,
for the
exactly.
Wake, the wake.
For a wake or for final identification of the remains or for whatever purpose. The concept behind the Fisk burial case is that the individual who died, and in most cases, from what we've learned, individuals who were buried in Fisk burial cases were not embalmed. The Fisk burial case was reported in Fisk's own literature to be highly effective because it really created a hermetical seal and preserved the remains without any further treatment.
So why would a family want their family members' remains preserved like that at that time?
Well, at that particular time, we were getting into that period where individuals, there was this whole, we think, this whole Victorian romantic notion about an individual loved one's remains moldering away in the ground. And it was distasteful. And so for centuries, there had been a variety of efforts to embalm bodies, and really that's something that we probably don't want to go into here, but it became very popular to perhaps ease the conscience of the living by offering some psychological form of additional preservation and protection.
Thus the cast iron.
Cast iron as an impervious material,
and
exactly.
Sealing it so air.
Sealing it in. We know they're highly effective. This particular example that we're specifically talking about was accidentally found down in or near Belleville, Illinois, in the late 1960s. And the local community had designated an area that was to be platted as a subdivision. And so they were extending a sewer line, either a storm sewer or a sanitary sewer, and this example was excavated. And the grave had not been marked, and there was no indication as to the name or details regarding the individual whose body was contained inside. However, the local county coroner, who also was a funeral director, was called in to investigate because this was a death that occurred but was not recorded in county record, predating vital records laws. And so the cast iron Fisk was opened, we are told, actually by the funeral director / coroner at the time, as he was personally involved, that the remains were perfectly preserved. There was no evidence of any embalming treatment. The remains were in a perfect state of preservation. The hair of the individual was perfectly styled. There was no deterioration to her garments. It was believed that she was between the age of 35 and 40. But again, no way of identifying who she was. And so her remains were removed from this particular burial case, placed in a modern burial casket, and then transferred to a public cemetery in the Belleville area.
So why were they not reinterred within the same metal?
Well, again, we don't know for sure, certain. Our suspicion is that because the Fisk burial case was seen as such an oddity or such a unique non-standard form of burial treatment, that it was believed that because of the rarity, the Fisk burial case in this instance should be protected and preserved. And so the Illinois Funeral Directors Association, interestingly enough, had in 1966 created the Illinois Funeral Service Foundation, which was created as an educational component of the Funeral Directors Professional Association. And we really date the association's interest in beginning to collect historic objects to that period in the late 1960s that would coincide with the discovery of the Fisk. Now, from Fisk's own literature that we have here in the collection, we know that these were very unusual. They tended to be fairly expensive in their day. Fairly expensive, of course, is a relative term, but we're talking in terms of $25, $30, $35, $40, $50.
But that's interesting that this woman's grave then was also not marked.
Well, again, we don't know whether this was a family burial plot in a rural area.
You don't know if there's nothing there.
Exactly. Yeah. There may have been a wooden marker. One would suspect if the family had gone to the expense of providing her with a Fisk burial case, given what I've just said about there being expensive items, it is surprising during that period that there wouldn't have at least been a what we would consider to be a standard white marble gravestone.
I'm actually surprised, since everything about it looks so permanent, that they, and since it's metal, that they wouldn't have engraved some information on it.
Well, the exhibit label is currently located conveniently on the only flat surface other than the underside. Mm-hmm. And I won't move the label because it may be attached properly to keep it from falling off. But beneath the exhibit label, there is a rectangular mm-hmm. space mm-hmm. that probably would have held a coffin plaque or nameplate, very similar to the nameplates that you see that we've got exhibited in a case nearby with other examples of casket hardware. And so we know that there were instances where those coffin plates would have been removed prior to the interment of the remains, and those coffin plates then were actually preserved by the family as a form of memorialization, even to the extent that we know that sometimes the coffin plates were given high places of high honor by being framed in shadow boxes.
So they were kept, yeah.
That would hang on the parlor wall. So in this case, she may have been known, but again, because we live in a society in which we don't necessarily think about the future and documentation. Everyone who knew her or would have known of her burial location probably considered that it was sufficient to know that she was buried in a specific location. And it's possible that the stone that had been used to mark her grave may have somehow disappeared or been destroyed or damaged prior to the discovery of her burial. And so, again, at this point, this woman simply rests in a grave, I believe, identified only as an unknown woman from the Belleville area. Now, I started to mention in Fisk's own literature, we have testimonials mentioned in his sales literature, if you will, that talks about the impervious character of cast iron and the preservative nature of cast iron as compared to what would be typical for that period from the late 1840s, when the design was first patented, until the mid-1860s, when we know that there were other manufacturers who were producing metallic burial cases that weren't necessarily in accordance with Fisk's designs. But interestingly enough, in Fisk's literature, he has a testimonial from Dolly Madison, who reported that she felt so confident about the preservative quality of the Fisk that she had President Madison's remains disinterred and placed in a Fisk, and then reinterred. And this would date probably from around 1850, 1852 or so. And
they were
believe
brand new then.
They would have been brand new. And I believe that the testimonial might even go so far as to say that she had already pre-purchased one or arranged for one for herself. We believe that there were other prominent politicians, John C. Calhoun, Daniel Webster. We believe they were also buried in Fisk burial cases. So again, these weren't containers designed for the average public citizen, but were designed to be marketed to a very distinct clientele. The other example, despite the fact that it appears to be wooden, is referred to in Fisk's catalog as an octagonal model. It's much more angular, as you can see, but it also is unique in that it has been faux painted in order to look like rosewood. So we don't know whether that was a clever marketing attempt to prove or undermine the argument that nothing could be better than the traditional wooden coffin that people were used to, and so for that reason they made it look like the standard burial case of the day, or whether they simply felt that it would be far more decorative to do the faux painting rather than to simply paint it black iron.
What period is that from?
Both of them, we believe, date from the 1848 to 1865.
So from the same period, because it looks so modern.
It does, and again, I guess modern is a relative term. To me, it looks very old-fashioned because I have the added benefit of knowing modern burial cases and their general design.
Well, I guess I'm thinking that the design almost looks Art Deco. It's very streamlined.
Yeah, very streamlined.
It's got a very smooth,
true.
You know, the way that it
true.
Looks. It doesn't look like these others that kind of look like torpedoes. And I'm wondering if they got it, you know, they look like these metal ones have taken on this. The few pictures that I've seen, they look like submarines or something. I mean, they've got this like
kind
heavy.
Of. Yeah, I don't know how the public would have reacted. It would be interesting to look.
I mean, it looks stylish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, obviously, it was meant to be stylish.
Mm-hmm.
If you
It's got a bigger window.
Bigger window, exactly. The Fisks, we understand, were, as I mentioned, highly effective, but interesting in that all that an individual could see through the window was really all that was there. And by that I mean, by today's standards, we consider looking at an open casket and we see decorative upholstery and padding and a pillow and possibly even embroidered mottos or symbols related to personalize the life of the individual or the individual's memberships. In this case, we've been told and we've discovered by looking at a couple of other Fisks as examples that the only part of the interior that was actually finished was that area around the viewing panel. So there would be very elaborate upholstery and possibly silk or satin or lace. The rest of the burial case may not have had anything other than a basic rudimentary amount of
padding
of some sort, which might have been a wooden, shaved wood excelsior, maybe not even the cotton batting that you see that is exposed in the second example. And to an extent, even today in modern funeral service, there is an element of that if it can't be seen, then we don't use elaborate materials.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be a secret that the funeral profession doesn't share often, but if I were to show you a modern burial casket, it would be evident that the part that is not publicly viewed is not inferior by any means, but it's certainly not as elaborately decorated, and the quality of the materials is not as high.
It's like the newscasters who are sitting behind the desk wearing their torn jeans.
Exactly, or shorts and sandals,
whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
If it doesn't show, it doesn't matter.
So why did Fisk put windows at all?
Well, it isn't that Fisk is the only one. The concept of putting the window in the coffin, burial case, later a casket, was to provide an opportunity for viewing. We know during a variety of periods throughout the 19th century when they were using, including windows. In some cases, the closed coffin or closed casket contained any odor from the decomposition of the remains, especially if the individual was not embalmed, and those natural bacteria continued to do their work and lead to decomposition and deterioration of the tissues. So in this case, the odor could be contained inside, and yet the face of the individual, which serves to be a reflection of character and personality, could be seen.
So it's for the benefit of the living.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because I was thinking about the cases in which people were buried but weren't dead, it turns out.
Well, exactly. We hear a lot of stories, if you will, or urban legend regarding premature burial, and we don't know how accurate those stories are and the degree of truth that is contained in them. There was a recent book called, now I'm on the hook. Jan Bondesen is the author, and Buried Alive is the title of the book, and it came out 3 or 4 years ago, published in hardback and then also in paperback, in which Bondesen, who is a scholar, studied the concept or the phenomenon or the mortal fear of premature burial. And I believe that he was able to conclude by taking a world view, primarily Western Europe and North America as his examples, that he had only found one actually recorded, documentable example of an individual who was buried alive. The urban myth is that there are certain changes, I guess, or signs that are seen in order to confirm premature burial. An individual's remains might have been discovered to have moved inside a casket or a coffin. And there are physical changes that take place as part of the decomposition period, the period of decomposition, that actually will move the body. It's not that the individual has come to life. There is also the phenomenon of what are called grave alarms. And these were devices
that were designed by the bell.
Exactly, and we don't think that the term saved by the bell applies to that at all, nor does the concept or term dead ringer, and even basket case. We hear a number of those terms bandied about with the assumption that they apply to funeral service, and we don't believe they do. But in the case of these grave alarms, there were a number of patents that were issued by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in the 19th century, and it's interesting to note that most of those patents predate the general use of embalming, because of course after the application of embalming, it's pretty certain that the individual is
gone.
No longer living.
Right.
And we don't know the extent to which the grave alarms were ever produced commercially. It would be an interesting study to conduct. We know that a number of patents were issued for them, I believe, from the early 1870s until around 1880. And again, we can document that the rise in popularity of actual embalming comes in the late 1870s.
Right.
So again, it makes a good story. But again, Bondesen's argument is man has, for millennia, had a mortal fear of being buried before death. And in talking with modern practicing funeral directors, there are a number of techniques that are used even today in modern funeral service to look for latent signs of life. And so even though medicine might not have been sufficiently advanced in the 19th century and a doctor might have misinterpreted what might have been a comatose state for actual death, my understanding is that these techniques that are used today were even used in the 19th century. Something so simple as holding a mirror under the nostrils.
Which is what I was thinking the glass would do to pick up.
Well, it would, but again, at that point, I think the undertaker or funeral director would have been fairly certain that life had ceased to exist before the individual was actually put in.
So let me ask you this, the word undertaker.
Yeah. The term is a very old one. In a general sense, from what we've been able to learn, the term undertaker simply referred to any individual mechanic practitioner who undertook to perform a certain function or service.
So it had to do with undertaking a job, because I was I was thinking it was because he was taking it under.
No. No, he was undertaking a funeral service. And even as late as the 1860s in the U.S., we know that the term undertaker was not synonymous with death, because we've seen evidence that suggests that those who performed burial rites or rituals or services were actually referred to as funeral undertakers.
So they were all calling them funeral.
So it wasn't considered to be redundant by any means. Mm-hmm. The funeral term had to be included to specify the form of undertaking or the service that was being performed.
Undertake the duties
of the funeral, exactly.
Right. Sounds good, though.
Yeah, it does. Again, urban myth, and as we've discussed about the project in general, the story changes, and it always seems to get to become a better story.
It does.
As it evolves.
It does. And it would seem to suit to change the story as it suits.
Exactly. Another example in the word shift. We think of the term funeral director or mortician undertaker over time as being that individual who performs the services related to handling, transportation, preparation mm-hmm. of the deceased for burial. And many people would argue that the term funeral director is simply a euphemism for undertaker, where we would argue, and based on some research that we've done, the term undertaker and funeral director were actually being used at the same time around 1880. Hmm. The 1880 period, which we've already talked about as being that period where embalming really had become much more widely applied and mm-hmm. accepted as a valid form of preservation, undertakers saw themselves as more than simply undertaking those burial rites and tasks, but instead as more organizers, event planners, if you will, mm-hmm. to put it in a more mm-hmm. modern term. Mm-hmm. And so they felt that to undertake the preparation of the remains did not adequately describe all of the duties that they were performing, from writing and submitting an obituary to a local newspaper, coordinating carriages in a funeral procession, coordinating details with the cemetery sexton, the clergy.
That is a real event planner.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the myth that we prefer to dispel is the fact that the term funeral director didn't simply develop in the 20th century as a term that we decided to apply because we were more comfortable mm-hmm. with it than the term undertaker, which was so old-fashioned. Even practitioners recognized that their duties were far broader than what their fathers and grandfathers had known in the earlier parts of the 19th century. And we've kind of digressed.
Yeah,
but it's all interesting.
But
it is related in a sense. Yeah, very much so.
So thank you, John, for talking with me. This has been a real pleasure.
You are welcome.